From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakraborty.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the week starts with the Department of Homeland Security announcing that they will revoke the temporary protected status of 200,000 migrants from El Salvador, some who've been here for decades. We will have that reporting for you today. But the morning shows were consumed by the president's reaction this weekend to Michael Wolff's book, Fire and Fury, in which Trump aides paint a picture of a mentally unstable president. The president responded that he's actually a very stable genius. And yesterday, senior White House advisor Stephen Miller ferociously defended the president, sidestepping questions from CNN's Jake Tapper.
I understand. You have 24 hours a day of anti-Trump material. You're not going to give 3 minutes for the American people
I get
to hear
it.
The real experience
of
Donald Trump.
There's one viewer that you care about right now, and you're being obsequious.
No,
you're being
which,
a factotum
no,
in order
being,
to please him, okay?
No.
And I think I've wasted enough of my viewers' time.
You know who I care about?
As Republicans,
Tapper went to commercial. The president tweeted moments later, Jake Tapper of fake news on CNN just got destroyed in his interview with Stephen Miller of the Trump administration. Watch the hatred and unfairness of this CNN flunky. Let's bring in NPR political lead editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there.
Look, the president's defenders say this is what they love about him, his combativeness. His detractors are saying that his weekend tweets confirm the image in the book of a childish, incompetent president. Where is this going?
Well, the president's certainly going to stick to the kind of strategy that he's been sticking to when it comes to taking on the media, when it comes to the kinds of tweets that he makes that even his supporters say they wish he might tamp down a little bit. But he sees that as integral to his to the kind of energy that he wants in his base. It's a continued disconnect, and it's really something that's going to continue to irritate Trump more the more people are talking about his mental state, and that it'll fuel a lot of the energy, frankly, heading into the 2018 midterms.
By the way, Steve Miller did say something that is directly contradicted by Donald Trump's own words. He did say he denied that any firing of CIA Director Comey had anything to do with the Russia investigation. Of course, on tape, Donald Trump, and CNN is happy to play it, Donald Trump made that comment where he said, yeah, then I thought about the Russia investigation and I fired him. So it's getting harder to just kind of deny these things.
Well, I mean, unless you think that you can just keep denying them.
Yeah, there you
go. You know, I mean, I think that's a big piece of what, you know, President Trump has written about, frankly, in his book, in The Art of the Deal. He said, you know, if you just say something, you can make people believe it.
What do you make of advisor Hope Hicks being pointed out as being a leading voice now in the White House? On CBS This Morning, it was pointed out that on almost every page of Michael Wolff's book, she has a mention. And here's what he had to say.
She became very close to the candidate and then very close to the president of the United States. And now, for all intent and purpose, she is the president's senior most advisor.
She's the president's senior most advisor. Hope Hicks, 29 years old. She was the former aide to Ivanka Trump. Your thoughts?
I don't know if she really is the president's senior most advisor. I mean, I think that his family is closest to him when it comes to his daughter Ivanka and his son-in-law Jared, and you know, in, to some respects, his sons, who he's somewhat walled off from or has less connection to. But I would put the family first. I think that everybody should. But the point that Hope Hicks has become close to the president, an integral part of the White House, that's absolutely true. She's been a consistent person throughout the campaign. Certainly, of course, it raised eyebrows that, you know, she's as young as she is. But there have been other people who are young in the White House before. But putting her as communications director with somebody who hasn't had any of that kind of experience, it's certainly different than we've seen before. But, you know, the president values loyalty over anything else. And she has kind of an impossible job as a communications director because she's not setting out communication strategy. The president is.
Look, yesterday, Steve Bannon issued a statement saying that when he said in the book that the meeting at Trump Tower with Russian, you know, affiliates was treasonous, he wasn't referring to Donald Trump Jr. He was referring to the president's campaign manager, former campaign manager Paul Manafort. But that all got obscured. Everything got obscured by the Golden Globes. And Oprah Winfrey making headlines because she was perceived in her speech there and backed up by her longtime boyfriend Stedman saying, you know, if she might run for president in 2020 if people want her. Your thoughts?
I think why not? I mean, I think that this is something people need to treat very seriously because, you know, Oprah, when she delivered that speech last night, it had all the makings of a political speech. When you listen to the way she talked and the lines that she used, being able to say, for example, a new day is on the horizon. What is she talking about? And then now you have people who are confirming to some outlets that she is thinking about it seriously. And Stedman was out there talking about it publicly. So I think that if Donald Trump can be president, anybody's going to think about running now.
Oh, come on. A reality TV show host billionaire becoming president.
Maybe we move toward a prime minister system here. I don't know.
NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Let's turn now to Pakistan. After the Trump administration's decision to suspend hundreds of millions of dollars in funding for the country, the president hopes this aid will force the government to take more action against militant groups who use Pakistan as a base for attacks in other countries. The BBC's Sukhinder Kirmani joins us from Pakistan. And Sukhinder, how is the country responding to this?
Well, the amount of money that we're talking about isn't huge. So in terms of concerns about what it could do to the Pakistani economy, officials and politicians here have been downplaying the impact of it. But certainly there has been almost universal hostility from across the political spectrum. The Pakistani foreign minister has said that the country is de facto not in an alliance with America anymore because this is not how allies treat each other. And there's been a lot of resentment about the idea that America hasn't appreciated what Pakistan has sacrificed in fighting against terrorism. I mean, thousands of Pakistani soldiers and civilians have died at the hands of militants over the last 16 years. And there's a sense here that America is asking them to do more when they've done a lot already. For the American side, though, of course, Pakistan has been selective in fighting against only certain types of terrorists. And they say that the Pakistani state, the Pakistani army, has been quite good, really, at eliminating those terrorists which are carrying out attacks in Pakistan. But they've been tacitly supporting and providing safe havens to those militants allied to the Afghan Taliban who are fighting against the Afghan government and against international forces there.
Okay, so to that point then, though, Sukhinder, I mean, what we have two different views of what may actually be the same situation. I mean, what is the truth here? Has Pakistan, according to the United States, been providing safe haven to terrorist groups who are then launching attacks in other countries?
Well, that's certainly been the allegation from the United States and from the Afghan government for a long time. In particular, the claims relate to a group called the Haqqani Network. They're a kind of subgroup of the Afghan Taliban. And they've long had some kind of link to the Pakistani intelligence services, or certainly historically they did. Relationships that were formed when the Afghans were fighting the so-called jihad against the USSR. And now it's believed by many analysts and certainly by, as I say, the Afghan government and the Americans, that those relationships between the Pakistani intelligence services and the Haqqani network still remain, and that there are elements within the Pakistani state who view the Haqqani network and the Afghan Taliban as a tool through which they can exert their foreign policy wishes, really. So they want to, fundamentally, it's alleged, see a Afghan Taliban influenced government in Afghanistan rather than the current government, because they believe that a Taliban government or a Taliban friendly government will be have better relations with Pakistan and will be an ally with them against their regional rival India.
Ah, very interesting point there. Okay, so let's talk about, I mean, you said that it may not actually be that much money, but will losing this aid hurt Pakistan or create any kind of instability? What would be the impact in Pakistan?
It's really about how what comes next, I think, that's the real concern. The U.S. has withheld tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of aid from Pakistan in the past as well. It should be pointed out that some of this money is not actually what we'd normally consider aid. It's or certainly what's not considered in Pakistan as aid. Part of it is called the Coalition Support Funds, and that's basically meant to be money that the U.S. pays please Pakistan to reimburse Pakistan for its costs in fighting against militant groups or for using Pakistani territory in supplying American troops in Afghanistan. For example, a lot of the supply routes that lead into Afghanistan go through Pakistan because Afghanistan doesn't, it's a landlocked country.
But finally, Sukunda, I'm just curious. You said much depends on what happens next, which is true. But we also talked about how Pakistan has said that the U.S. move to cut aid sort of undermines the fact that the U.S. and Pakistan are allies. So do you think that this may do long-term damage to the relationship between the two countries?
What we could end up seeing is an even greater level of tensions between the two countries. We could even see potentially Pakistan labeled as a state sponsor of terrorism, which is something that people here would be very concerned about.
Well, the BBC's Sukunda Kermani speaking to us today from Islamabad. Sukunda, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Lawmakers in high-cost, high-tax blue states are looking for ways around the provision in the new Republican tax law that puts a $10,000 cap on state and local tax deductions. They're known as SALT taxes. These were changes meant to offset the tax breaks the law gave big corporations. Democrats in states like California, New Jersey, and New York say those changes unfairly target them, will hurt their chances to recruit new workers or raise taxes. One solution, in his State of the State address last week, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said he would sue the Trump administration.
Washington's tax plan now uses New York and California as piggy banks to finance tax cuts for Republican states. New York will pay an additional $14 billion on top of the $48 billion that we currently pay.
We will take up some of the plans from Democrats to end run the law tomorrow. But on the other side of the debate, conservatives like Stephen Moore. He's a fellow with the think tank, the Heritage Foundation. He was also a senior economic advisor to the Trump campaign. He's long argued for these tax changes and says instead of making local laws to circumvent the federal tax law, residents of liberal states should rise up with pitchforks and demand lower taxes, less spending, and maybe just rise up and leave. Stephen Moore joins us now. Have I got that right? You've written about this idea that people should move from New York, say, to no-tax or low-tax red states like Nevada or Texas. Move?
Well, you know, it's a brave new world out there for the states. There's no question about it that the elimination of the state and local tax deduction really changes the playing field for states, specifically states like California, New York, New Jersey, and then even states with high property taxes like my home state of Illinois. Under the old law, tax filers could write off about 35% to 40% of those taxes off their federal tax forms. Now they can't, and that makes the high taxes much more difficult for especially wealthy people to pay. And therefore, I do think you are going to see a choice that states are going to have to make. Either they're going to have to lower their taxes to be more competitive, or I do think they're going to face an out-migration of people who say, look, I can pay a 13% tax in New York or California, or I can move to Texas or Florida or New Hampshire or Nevada, states like that that have no income tax and dramatically reduce my tax burden. So it's going to be a very fascinating thing to see how these states adjust to this new tax regime.
Well, is this part of a plan? These are blue states that you're talking about, and people moving from blue states to red states, and you've been pushing for this for a long time. Is this part of a plan to destabilize blue states?
No, it's not. But I think that I have always made the argument that it's not fair for residents of low-tax states to have to pay higher federal taxes to subsidize the high taxes of states like California, New York, and Connecticut, and so on. Now, I believe in states' rights. States should be able to do whatever they want. And if you want a lot more government services and to pay higher taxes in California and New York, that's what makes our country a wonderful thing. You can choose where you want to live. But it is also true, and our evidence shows this pretty clearly, that states do pay a price for having high taxes because people do move. And I'll give you just one example. In the last 10 years, California and New York have lost 1 million residents on net to other states, whereas Texas and Florida have each gained about 1 million residents on net to, from other states. So you are seeing a shift gradually over time of people moving from the high-tax northeastern and coastal states on the West Coast more to the South because taxes are lower there.
I'm just going to jump in to say that in New England, we call them snowbirds. A lot of people move south for the warmth.
The weather. There's no doubt about that.
But I want to take up some of your points that you've just made.
By the way, let me just respond to that because it is an important point. And there's no question. I mean, there are a lot of reasons that people move from one state to another. There's no question. And taxes are only one of a multitude of reasons. But, you know, if it were only weather, you know, why are people moving from San Diego, California to Houston, Texas?
I want to take up your point, though, that you and others make that this is there's an unfairness to this.
Yeah.
And House Speaker Paul Ryan, speaking with the president of your organization, again, the Heritage Foundation, back in October, made this point that it's, you know, red states subsidizing blue states, again, because the blue states, they have the much higher taxes, but they get tax returns to their citizens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to Paul Ryan.
Things like state and local deduction, which I would argue we're propping up profligate big government states, and we're having states that actually got their act together pay for states that didn't. I think Wisconsin versus Illinois, that's what rushes to my mind.
As an Illinois,
I know, that's why these words come. So these are the issues that we have to help members see the big picture.
But Stephen Moore, there are others who make the argument that, yes, people in the blue states where there's much higher taxes do get returns, federal returns, and those are federal dollars that others pay into. But they also pay the higher taxes that they would say subsidize the red states. The red states that are not paying these high taxes, on average, get far more federal dollars than the taxes that they actually pay. The Atlantic did a study of this. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. Mm-hmm. South Carolina, for instance, takes in nearly $8 for every dollar its residents pay in taxes. And those dollars come from the blue states.
Right. And the irony is that the blue state representatives and senators are the ones who vote for all this government spending. I mean, they tend to, if you look at the National Taxpayer Union, what we find is that the representatives of the blue states tend to be much more pro-spending than the representatives of the
blue states. Well, but what would you not spend
on?
Let's look at schools. Let's look at child care. Let's look at, you know, single moms with kids. You know, people would say, you know what? Massachusetts, New York, they have education. They have job creation, and they are helping other states that don't pay the taxes, you know, build their roads, do the things that they're not paying for.
Well, let me give you an example, because this is a great point, and it's worthy of debate. So I just looked at the numbers about how much state and local spending per capita is in, for example, New York State, which has the highest state and local spending per capita of any state. They spend about $13,000 per resident. Then I looked at other states like Tennessee. Now, Tennessee is booming. They have great public services. They have good schools. They have good police and fire protection. And they spend $6,500 per person. So think about this. New York State gets worse public services than Tennessee does, but Tennessee spends half per person what New York does. So the point is that how much you spend doesn't necessarily dictate how good your schools are. If that were the case, then, you know, I'm from Chicago, Illinois. Chicago would have the best schools in the country. In fact, Chicago has about the worst schools in the country.
Well, you can bat these back all day. Historian Bruce Schulman writes in the Washington Post about Massachusetts, which happens to be his home state and would be, again, a big loser under this new tax blueprint. He says, you know, Massachusetts ranks number one in the latest U.S. News Survey of Education. South Carolina is at the bottom. You know, it just you could bat these back and forth.
Yeah, but look, you can look at, you know, one state versus another. But if you just look at all 50 states and do a correlation, there is virtually no relationship spending per pupil in states versus the quality. Iowa and Utah are states that spend very little per person, and they have some of the best schools. But there's another point I think that's really important here, which is under the new tax regime, because we doubled the standard deduction, now you can write up your first $24,000 of income is tax-free if you're a family. And that what that means is that well over 90% of Americans are no longer going to take deductions. In other words, they're just going to check the box and not take any deductions for charities, for mortgage, for state and local tax deduction. And what that means is that virtually, I mean, this is a little exaggeration, but not much, It's only the 10% richest Americans that will take the state and local tax deduction.
Okay, and you've made your point. And then two that are made by people who support keeping SALT the way it is, capping it, changing the current structure, and perhaps encouraging people to move to states that have lower or no taxes in different areas, is going to strain state budgets, not just the ones that where you've changed the structure, but it's going to absolutely strain the budgets of the states where people are moving who don't have the tax policy, which is going to require more federal dollars, and you at the Heritage Foundation are for less government spending. And also changing these policies to make way for the tax cuts for the very rich and corporations is upwards redistribution, is giving the money to the more wealthy. Any kind of redistribution doesn't seem to be a Heritage policy. So just respond to those.
Sir, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, it is flat out false to say that eliminating the state and local tax deduction is a regressive policy. It's actually progressive because the people who are most angry about losing the state and local tax deduction are very, very, very rich people, millionaires and billionaires in very high income states like Massachusetts, New York, California, and so on. So by eliminating the state and local tax deduction, we actually make the tax code more progressive than it would otherwise be. That's point number one. Point number two, it is, in my opinion, wrong to say that states are losers in this tax reform. We believe that over the next 10 years, since starting right away, that economic growth will be substantially higher as a result of this tax bill. So I don't agree with this that states and localities are losers. They are winners in this tax reform because the economy will be bigger. They'll have more taxpayers.
Stephen Moore, distinguished fellow with the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, a couple thoughts. Many people who pay high taxes in high-cost cities like New York or San Francisco would not call themselves millionaires. And when blue state liberals move to red states, those states can start to change. Ask New Hampshire. Democrats say it's because people want the services that come from the higher taxes. But your thoughts on Stephen's thoughts are welcome at herenow.org. And tomorrow we'll hear from a left-leaning economist who rejects his thinking. He says the tax law will hurt blue states, which will ultimately hurt red states. That's tomorrow.
Wildfires can have major effects on forest ecosystems. They can alter the soil and affect plant and animal species. In Oregon, scientists have found that the blackened remains of a 2013 wildfire are a fantastic laboratory to study insects not often associated with forests, bees. Jess Burns from EarthFix reports.
About 100 yards down a steep, shrubby slope, there's a low post supporting a green and blue plastic jug.
This is a blue vein trap.
Field technician Sydney Watkins can't see the natural ultraviolet light reflecting off the funnel-shaped mouth of the trap, but bees can.
The bees really like the UV. It attracts them. So that's why they're colored that way. And we can look inside and see if we got anything.
She peers through the narrow opening.
Oh my gosh. There's so much in here. Baby halictids.
She's talking about the dozens of tiny bees trapped inside, most of them dead. Watkins pulls off the lid.
Pop this off carefully, because a lot of times, some of our sites, there's a lot of bees in here, and you have to be really careful that they don't fly out, because, you know, that's the whole reason we're out here.
And shakes the bees into a labeled Ziploc.
Nice and safe.
The bees will be taken back to a lab at Oregon State University, where they'll be counted and identified. Researcher Sarah Galbraith's team is collecting bees at dozens of sites in the scar of the Douglas Complex fire. Some of the spots burned lightly, and in others, all the trees were reduced to sticks and then salvage logged.
In the moderate, high, and high fire severity categories, there's pretty low canopy cover, so you get more flowering plants that come in.
In these places where more than 50% of the canopy burned, it's also warmer, and there's potentially more bare soil, giving bees easier access to underground burrows.
We're finding that with increased disturbance in our sites, so increased fire severity, we're finding higher abundance of bees, and we also get more bee species.
Jim Rivers of the OSU Forest Animal Ecology Lab says this kind of baseline information about native bees is exactly what we need.
And so if we want to understand how pollinators are changing through time, how they're responding to different management action or climate change or anything else across a time scale, we really need to have a starting point, and we don't have that right now.
All of this research will ultimately be used by land managers like Bruce Holland of the Bureau of Land Management.
I use science created by people smarter than me with much more experience to try and respond to regulatory and legal requirements that BLM has.
These requirements include making sure the agency doesn't do anything that drives sensitive species to extinction. Things like clear cuts, salvage logging, invasive species removal, fire treatments, herbicide use.
We may get it right for yellow jackets and bald-faced hornets and naturalized European honeybees, but there's a whole lot out there that we could probably learn from.
Bees pollinate about 90% of our native plants, but they're thought to be in decline. So the severe wildfire we're seeing more and more across the United States may be just the thing that allows these pollinators to thrive. And study lead Sarah Galbraith is beginning to think about another possibility that hits even closer to home, that there's a critical link between forests and farmland.
So by protecting our pollinators in the forests, we are potentially protecting our food security now and into the future.
But before that connection can be fully explored, researchers will need to learn more about how the bees use our forests. For Here and Now, I'm Jess Burns.
In 2010, Kalief Browder was locked up at Rikers Island Prison in New York when he was only 16 years old. He was never convicted of a crime. He hadn't yet had a trial, but he spent 3 years at Rikers, suffering abuse at the hands of inmates, guards, and he also spent 2 years in solitary confinement. The reason he was there? His family was too poor to afford bail.
Well, my family tried to get me a public, tried to get me a lawyer, but my family was doing, they was going through some hard times at the time, so they couldn't post bail or either get me a lawyer.
Browder was eventually released, but he took his own life in 2015 at just 22 years old. Georgetown law professor Peter Edelman has long been an advocate for the poor. He worked in the 1960s with Robert Kennedy and more recently for the Bill Clinton administration. And he says that Kalief Browder's life and death is just one of many stories that show how the criminal justice system is tilted radically against poor Americans. I spoke with him recently about what inspired his new book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. What is it that triggered your attention and focus specifically on how smaller aspects of the criminal justice system lead to such, you know, terrible outcomes like Kalief Browder had?
One word for me, Ferguson. Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about Kalief Browder, this is something that people knew about. People knew and know about how terrible Rikers is.
Yeah.
So the entry point for me in writing this book was not that. You inevitably get to Kalief Browder and the bail and how it is that the mental health places are the jails, not what we thought we were doing decades ago. But for me, it was finding out that not just Michael Brown, but the fact that they were in that small city were arresting their own people over and over again and squeezing them to get the money to run their city, and then to discover that that's a national fact.
Yeah. So there was the Justice Department's at least one of those studies coming out of post-Ferguson.
Fabulous report. Yeah. That was part of my learning.
So let's talk about in a little bit more detail then. I mean, when you say that in America, it has essentially become a crime to be poor, or it feels like that. I mean, what are some of the specific reasons for or ways in which we're seeing that?
Well, two categories here in the book. One is the fines and fees and how that has turned into this way of getting income to run the state or the city or the court system. And what happens, it really entraps people by the millions, and it's major, actually, in terms of the majority of it, is taking away people's driver's licenses that we have all over the country, 4 million people in California alone. But the other piece is it turns out that it's metastasized, and we're talking about kids who get sent to jail, to court, for something in the old days before would have been something at the principal's office.
And right.
So other things besides the fines and fees.
Well, but on the fines and fees, for example, I just want to focus on that for a moment.
Yes.
Because, I mean, as you write about, and others have as well, we're seeing all sorts of small fines and fees now for failure to showing up for a certain court date or failure to do X or Y, which can pile up on individual poor Americans. But the reason why cities and towns have have levied so much, what is the reason for that? I mean, obviously, the money is being used for something.
Yes. Why? Well, the reason why is the anti-tax rebellion. People all over the country, those units of government all over the country found that they were falling short because they didn't have the tax revenue. And in a rather cruel decision, they decided really all over the country to get the money out of their own citizens. And so that's why we have it. And it has been done in a way that is particularly hard on low-income people, and they're everywhere. They're disparately African-American and in other parts of the country, Latino.
I mean, is it going too far to say that we, in certain places, we have reached a system where poor Americans are being squeezed in order to subsidize a criminal justice system that they themselves are being cycled through?
Yes, and it's happening here in Massachusetts and has been for some time, having to have fees to be on probation, having to have fees to have a public defender, things you wouldn't think were going on here. There's good work going on right now among the leaders of both of the courts and in the legislature, and so the Commonwealth is moving in the right direction.
Well, since you brought up Massachusetts, I've got some numbers here that might help us sort of understand what's happening here in this state. For example, about bail reform, we had an SJC case that said that bail shouldn't be set beyond a person's ability to pay for it.
Yes.
And to put that in some context here, I was seeing some numbers from a study that said that more than 5,000 people every day in Massachusetts are face pretrial incarceration. So it's not an insignificant number. And you see some like major disparities. There was a 2014 study that said in Middlesex County, for example, on October 31st, 2014, 22% of people in jail in Middlesex County on that day were there because they couldn't post $1,000 in bail.
Yes, and nationally, you have 700,000 people who were in jail on any given day, and 3/5 of those people are not yet, they have not been tried. And that's about bail that they can't pay. And the reason for that is the system doesn't have the capacity to have the trials. And so what they do is they use bail to squeeze people to come and plead guilty. Which in turn, for something they didn't do, in turn gets them into owing a lot of money. So it's a tool for that. And then once they're hooked, when they can't pay, it just goes on and on because added debts get piling up.
Well, again, just for context here, because some of the numbers are quite shocking. Mass Inc. did a study, and they found out in 2015 in Barnstable County, the median bail amount for a white person was $5,000. The median bail amount for a black person in Barnstable County was $20,000. So talk about the disparity.
Yes, well, absolutely. There's all the way through all of these things, there's a racial disparity, and that's part of the story. It's a story of race and poverty, poverty and race, very dangerous intersection.
Yeah. Advocates are really trying to move bail from a cash-based system, like we've been talking about, to one that's more evidence-based in terms of dangerousness.
That's right. And we have two things that are going on around the country. One is there are lawsuits that are beginning to be successful. The biggest one in Houston, Harris County in Texas, where the federal judge has declared that the system down there is unconstitutional because of the rich-poor difference. So that's coming along around the country. There are a number of these cases. But the second is that D.C. has been doing it basically right for 40 years. So it was always out there, and Kentucky had done it. But now we have this system that the Arnold Foundation has supported, which creates a way very carefully researched. This is the right way to do it, is to have statewide statutory change so that we really don't, it's much harder to fall back into the bad ways of doing it.
So let's presume for a moment that some of these reforms work. Where does that leave the same towns and their court systems that are so reliant on the income that's produced from charging fees for and posting high bails from all these poor people?
It's a problem. The answer is they're going to have to figure it out, because this is not something that's acceptable.
Right.
But they got into it in the first place. People who, at least in some places, are sort of well-meaning, and they fell into it, and then it's an addiction.
Well, Peter Edelman is a law professor at Georgetown University. His new book, It Is Not a Crime to Be Poor. Professor Edelman, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've heard the stats. The economy is booming, a soaring stock market, jobs added for 75 consecutive months. Our next guest says when looking ahead and wondering if that boom will continue in 2018, one thing we need to think about is inflation. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York as always. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
And you write in your piece that if the economy continues to do well, we might see higher inflation. Okay, you also write a little bit of inflation is not a disaster, but people tend to think inflation, things cost more. My buying dollar doesn't go as far. Remind us what inflation is and why it can be a good thing.
Inflation is just prices going up and down. And a little bit of inflation is like yeast in bread. Both too little and too much ruins the loaf, but a little of it makes the dough rise. The right amount of inflation, say between 2% or 3%, can push up wages, stimulate economic expansion. If you have a little bit of inflation, it encourages people to buy more stuff. And one of the reasons why the economy has felt so feeble in the last few years, with GDP growth being so weak, has been that inflation has been too low. It's not deflation. It's not like prices are falling constantly all over the place. It's just really low inflation. And to torture the bread metaphor maybe one more time, if the dough isn't rising, that's a bad thing. You should want a challah economy rather than a matzah economy. Economy with a little bit of a bite to it, not too much of that dry crunch. And I say this as a loving Jew myself.
Okay. Well, something went by kind of fast there because you tied wages to inflation. And you remind us that when people start paying people a little bit more, then they raise their prices a little bit more for their products because they're paying people more. That's a good thing.
That is a good thing. Yes, you nailed it. Absolutely. That is a good thing. That's why you don't want the opposite. The opposite is deflation. And in a deflationary spiral, you tend to have people holding on to their money, hoarding their money, not spending things. That means you have less growth. That means there are fewer people in restaurants and fewer people dropping off their stuff at the dry cleaner. A little bit of inflation stimulates economic activity, and that stimulates demand, and that gets a more virtuous cycle flowing.
Well, you can kind of manipulate inflation and costs. And the Federal Reserve has had a target. You said 2%, 2-3 was the preferred target, but they've missed the mark. Why?
Yeah, there are a couple reasons. I'll quickly list four. First, the Great Recession was a terrible, deep recession where families lost their jobs, housing values plummeted, they spent less. That's definitely contributed to lower overall growth and low inflation. Second, we, like every other country in the world that's an advanced economy, we're getting older, and aging populations tend to restrain economic growth a bit because pensioners, by definition, don't work very much. Mm-hmm. Third, because of the internet and all the telecommunications technology that's coming around, you tend to have lower prices. Uber tends to make urban transit cheaper. Amazon and Walmart tend to hold down retail prices, so you have lower inflation there.
I just want to stop you there for one second, because that was fascinating to me, because we have this new economy that's doing a lot of things on the cheap. That's keeping this natural kind of inflation of costs down.
Yes, it is. I mean, the cliche here, but the useful cliche is imagine all of the various equipment that you would have to buy from Radio Shack in order to squeeze into the brick that we now call an iPhone. Mm-hmm. It would cost thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars for an instrument that now you can buy for a couple hundred dollars. So technically, right there, you could say that the iPhone, Apple, is a deflationary product. You know, it's not maybe the most useful way to think about all the various economic activity that can be unleashed by the iPhone, but the instrument itself, you could argue, is deflationary. And a lot of IT, a lot of internet and modern tech is indeed holding down prices. And while, of course, there are good sides to that, you know, cheap toilet paper, you know, cheap stuff from Amazon and Walmart, there also is the side effect that lower prices overall, lower inflation, can potentially withhold a little bit of economic activity.
And by the way, some of the things that you see as you research this to prove this point of tying wage inflation and overall inflation, Cheesecake Factory can't keep its workers around without raising wages, but also prices. Another low-wage job, delivery drivers. It's in such high demand that it was the third most popular job listing on Monster.com in 2017. And if people are really competing for these low-wage workers, that's going to push up those wages and those prices will follow. Fascinating. But how does the tax cut, the Republican tax cut in about the minute we have, how does that play into this?
Well, the Republican tax cut is a really fascinating government experiment in a way. We've never had a multi-hundred-billion-dollar tax cut at 4% unemployment.
Pretty full.
8 or 9 years yeah. into a recovery. We've never tried anything like this. When we had similar unemployment in a similarly long economic expansion in the late 1990s, if you recall, Clinton was running a surplus. There wasn't a deficit. There was a surplus. The government was taking in more than it was spending. Now we're doing the opposite. And most economists do think that if you inject hundreds of billions of dollars into an economy that is growing, where unemployment is already low, where wage growth is just beginning to perk up, that you should have the beginning of that very phenomenon that we've been talking about, wage inflation.
Wage inflation tied to inflation. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. It's fascinating. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. Thanks as always, Derek.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.